Welcome to Red Inker. I'm Jared Kimber.
This episode of Red Inker is about a man who has coached everywhere.
Andy Moles, former first-class cricketer with Warwickshire and Griqualand West in South Africa, and coach of many international cricket teams. Currently unemployed after having my leg amputated, but I'm sure we'll discuss that. Although I do probably 6 weeks a year with the Bahamas cricket team.
We discuss New Zealand, Hansi Cronje, Bob Woolmer, Warwickshire, Scotland, Kenya, Brendan McCullum, the Taliban, bombs, and losing a leg. Just to let everyone know that towards the end of this episode, Andy does talk about his leg being amputated, and that may not be something that everyone wants to listen to. And so you decided to write this book. What, you know, you've had this incredible life in cricket. Where did the sort of the idea for the book come from?
Friends of mine have been on to me for a while about that they think I have a story to tell and people would like to hear it. I was reticent really at first because, you know, I'm no test player, although some people said I should have had an opportunity. But I'm not a household name. I had a more than successful career as a county cricketer in England, and I did well in South Africa when I went to play first class cricket there as an overseas player. But really it came down to I was worn down by two guys, Tim Munton, who's my ex teammate at Warwickshire, and Tony Finch, who is sort of my best mate over here in England. And they said, look, for no other reason than put it down for your kids. You know, I've got two boys, Daniel and Matthew. And they said, look, they can look up your career as a player and they can see, but they don't know everything, the trials and tribulations you went through in your coaching career, both, the ups and the downs. And they persuaded me that should be something that I should put down in a book.
No, it's a fascinating one, just because your career is so interesting. I mean, most professional cricketers are kind of in the system by 15, 16, 17. You don't start playing cricket until 15, and you don't get a professional contract till what, your mid-20s, is that right?
25, yeah. What happened is that I was always meant to be, and everybody thought I'd be a professional footballer. Football was my sport growing up. I say growing up, you know, up to the age of 15, I broke my leg playing rugby, or my ankle, I should say, and one or two teams who were interested in me. So I said, well, you won't be the same again because you've got to have a year off basically for rehab and other players will overtake you. So they sort of dropped me. So I was at school and started looking around for other sports. So I took up cricket. I loved it. I have a canny knack for all hand-eye coordination for all sorts of sports, whether it be badminton, table tennis, rugby, football, whatever, you know, cricket. I just seem to be able to turn my hand to it, as it were. And, I took to cricket and had an exceptional coach, an old Warwickshire player called Fred Gardner, picked me up and put me under his wing. That's when I was about 17, 18. And he worked with me. And some people say I ended up mimicking the way he used to play. He was a very solid opening batsman for Warwickshire. Scored 100 against Australia, funny enough, for Warwickshire way back when. And I picked up a lot of his traits, and that's how really I got up and going. I went to Moseley in the Birmingham League, who played obviously in the Birmingham League, and Warwickshire Seconds used to play in that league at the weekends. So all the young pros trying to make it were in that league team. And I played against them a couple of times when I was 20, 21, and suddenly realised, you know, they're no better than I was. So that's what gave me the impetus really to really get between my teeth and go and try and be a professional cricketer. Luckily, it turned out.
I mean, you say you become a professional cricketer, but what's really fascinating is you don't just end up in any side. You end up in one of the most famous county sides ever. Like not just Warwickshire as a club, but you were there for Warwickshire's treble. Like, that's not like an averagely talented side, right? There are freaks of nature all around you at that point.
Yeah, well, when I joined, I joined in 86. The treble was 94. So, you know, it was good, what, 6 or 8 years later,
yep,
than won the treble. But what we did, we were an aging side when I got in with three or four young players in it, and with the Bob Cotton came in as coach under Andy Lloyd as captain, who sort of changed our mentality of thinking. We used to play for draws when I first got into the side, and that we twisted things around to be a bit more a lot more positive in the way we played. And after that, Dermot Reeve and Bob Woolmer were in charge of us sort of a couple of years before we actually won the treble. And they worked very, very well about, you know, trying to get rid of fear of failure in the dressing room, trying to encourage us to explore different ways to play, encouraging us that if we got out trying things, as long as we practiced it in the nets, it was no issue. But if we went out there and played some strange shot that we hadn't been practicing, then we used to get our backsides kicked. But you know, if we discussed things with the coach and what we're trying to do, and he was very, Bob Woolmer was way ahead of his time, you know, with what he used to sort of get us to, the way we thought about the game. You know, he used to always talk about, you've got to be good technically, good mentally, and good physically. And there's always one of those areas that you can always improve. So if you're playing very, very well, scoring lots of runs, your mentality would usually be quite good because you're scoring runs. But can you work on your physical? So there's always something he used to talk to me about because I was larger than the average bear, shall we say. So, you know, he was always on to me about, you know, you can do a little bit more swimming or do something. Never stand still. Always look to push the envelope. Always look to try and be better than you are at the moment.
Is Bob Woolmer part of the reason that you sort of look towards becoming a coach, or is that just maybe a natural thing within you?
No. I was one winter selling fire extinguishers because back in when I was playing, we were only employed for 6 months of the year. Yeah. So the other 6 months, the club would say, well, off you go. We'll see you again before the pre-season. And we used to have a winter net 2 months before the start of the pre-season. We had Tuesday nights in the rain and the cold in the indoor school. But apart from that, there was no contact from the club. We were left to our own devices. Sort your own fitness out. There was no fitness instructors or anything like that around then. And Bob said to me after I'd been selling fire extinguishers for 1 year, why don't you become a coach? You know, you think about the game. And he put me on. So I started doing my coaching badges or courses whilst I was still playing. And then did some coaching on Saturday mornings in the winter with the kids in the indoor school. Then joined a program that Warwickshire got up and running in the inner city schools of Birmingham in the winter. So I went to schools, I think I did three schools a day, looking at, you know, very basic grip, stance, back lift, how to hold the ball for seamers, spinners, and then just a little bit of fielding, correct ways to catch. Very, very basic stuff. And I loved it and enjoyed it. And I used to enjoy seeing, you know, a lot of these youngsters improving. So I went from there really and went on and on. I did my level three and did my level four in South Africa when I was over there. And really that Bob Woolmer was a big encouragement to me to, you know, chase the coaching dream.
What specifically did you learn from sort of his methods? He's kind of, you know, the scientist and the professor of cricket, but also you talk to the players like yourself who dealt with him. You know, he was very good at the sort of the soft skills of coaching as well, you know, the teaching aspect and everything else. What were the bits that you sort of took from Bob Woolmer and started with you in on your own coaching journey?
I think, first of all, there's no excuses. There could be no shortcuts. So, you know, if you're not doing very well, do not blame anybody else. Look at the person in the mirror. He's a reason why you're doing well or you're not doing well. Secondly to that, he used to talk around ensuring that you prepared properly. You know, have you thought about your position? Have you thought about how, as a batter, opening batter, I used to think about how bowlers got me out in previous games, because I know bowlers would turn around and try and repeat the same way that they got me out before. So I'd practice beforehand to make sure I could negate that issues. But the big thing that Bob used to work upon is don't be afraid. Always play. And the other thing, play the way you practice, or practice the way you play. You know, there's two ways of looking at it. Everyone says, you know, you got to play the way you practice. But the other thing, on the other boot, which is more engaging, is practice the way you play. In other words, don't take it easy in practice. Ensure that you're putting yourself under pressure. Ensure that the bowlers are working hard. I mean, in my practice, I had Alan Donald, Gladstone Small, Tim Munton, Dermot Reeve, Paul Smith, to name four. Neil Smith was a spinner with Ashley Giles. I mean, that was a test attack. And I used to make, I never used to bat first thing. I used to always go in second or third so that they were loose and they were firing. And I'd say to him, bring it on. Because I know if I practiced with match intensity right there and then, and I played well and I don't make excuses and commit to practice, then I'd be ready for whoever we were playing the next day.
you have this really good career, as you say. You don't quite make it to England, probably maybe in part because you did start a little bit later. Had you started as a professional a little bit earlier, you probably would have played for England, especially through that period. But you have this great playing career. We talked about the treble with Warwickshire. But then you go on this coaching journey, which is probably one of the most fascinating. And I've been following it for quite some time. First, you start with Kenya. You take over Kenya just after they're in the World Cup semifinals. People don't know a lot about that team. That team almost didn't make it to the 2003 World Cup because it was breaking in half. You kind of come in. There's no money. There's terrible facilities. What is it like to coach Kenya at that point?
Yeah, well, that's the first international side. My first coaching appointment was Orange Free State.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Hansi Kroneer's captain, Alan Donald in the side, Nicky Bouyer, Buta Dipanar, all test players for South Africa. So that was a real learning curve. Hansi Kroneer was such a great pro. Can't condone what he got himself involved in, you know, with the match fixing. But he was such a thinker of the game, and he challenged me mentally.
Was he similar to someone like Dermot Reeve, that they thought about the game very differently?
Probably Dermot was a little bit more happy-go-lucky than Hansi. Hansi was very much a disciplinarian, but very fair and very understanding and very supportive. Mm. So, you know, as a human being, I thought Hansi was a very, very good man. So then I went to Kenya. Yeah, so Kenya, after they got to the quarterfinals, was it in the World Cup?
Semi-final. Yeah.
I think, you know, we've got to look at that upon. They got there mainly because New Zealand refused to go to Kenya.
New Zealand didn't play in a game. Some things went in their favour, but they did beat a couple of good sides and play some good cricket as well.
They beat Sri Lanka, so they did well. Yeah. But if they've had to play all the games, they probably wouldn't have got to the semi-final. No. But don't take anything away from them. You know, you can only beat who's put in front of you. And they had some good cricketers, dangerous cricketers. You know, we'll talk later about Afghanistan. I mean, dangerous cricketers, in my view, are people that do well every now and again. You know, people who are consistent, you look at the other top players in the world, they regularly do well. But, you know, the Kenyan players have two or three players who could be match winners, but they do it 2 out of 10. And that was frustrating because you needed them to do it a little bit more often than that.
And you go from there. I know you coach domestically as well, so there's so many coaching gigs. I can't go through them all. But not long after that, you're coaching in Scotland.
Correct.
You sign an extension in Scotland. You're trying to bring professionalism into an amateur system. And Scotland is a team that both of us have worked for, so I'm very aware of the limitations and the way that Scottish cricket sees itself sometimes, and it almost wants to be amateur. It sounds from your book, and also from knowing a little bit about Scottish cricket, that you're trying to professionalise this team, and they're like, no, we play cricket the way that we play cricket, and we want to go about it this way.
Yeah, I mean, throughout my coaching career, I think one of my strengths is spotting young talent. Only if we qualified, which we did, we'd get the extra finance, then they could afford to keep. So I only signed an 8-month contract. Once that contract was up, the Warwickshire job became available. So I went to see the CEO, Roddy Smith, and said, look, you know, this has come up. It's my club. I've always played there. It's really where I want to be at some stage. And the can't always pick when opportunities arrive. And that job came up. So he said, no, apply, no problem at all. We'll offer you a 2-year contract, and it'll kick in if you don't get the Warwickshire job. Okay, fine. So everything was smooth. I went down for the job, and, you know, we'll talk about it later maybe, but, you know, it didn't quite come off for one or two reasons. Great Batch was appointed, who a lot of people would say was probably not one of the better appointments of the career. He clashed with the players a little bit, but that happens with all coaches, you know, not all coaches, but that's one of the problems coaches have if they don't want to play. But the Scotland players, the senior players, weren't happy, I found out, that I was looking to encourage, shall we say, and promote the younger players in and around the side so that we had the next level of players coming up. You know, this was something that Bob always taught me, is that senior players can be lazy because they're used to doing things their way. Players, Steve Waugh used to always say as well, players who play at the best are always under pressure. They're under pressure for their places. They're under pressure to perform. If they're in their happy lazy position. In other words, they know they're always going to play. Then they don't, as Bob Warren used to say, you've got to push yourself to get better all the time. You can't stand still. And I thought one or two of the Scottish players were resting on their laurels after we qualified for the West Indies. So all I did is I promoted or made them aware that I was working with four or five of the younger players to put them under pressure to work harder before we went to the World Cup in the West Indies. Unfortunately, they rebelled whilst I was out of the country in South Africa, and basically player power, they got rid of me, which was a great shame.
Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. We won't go through all your coaching appointments, Annie, because we'll be here all day, and that's why people should buy the book. But you do coach Hong Kong, Kenya, and Scotland, yeah. And all three have similar problems. Hong Kong and Scotland have this sort of amateur system that they can't get over. Kenya had some high vision of where they wanted to be in cricket, but there was no funding, really. Yeah. How hard is it to coach when, you know, I mean, and you know this because you used to sell fire extinguishers. How hard is it to coach when someone has a full-time job and you're trying to bring in a sort of Bob Woolmer level of professionalism and organization and structure, but that isn't really the situation that Hong Kong, Kenya, and Scotland are in?
No, I mean, as I've mentioned a few times, my coaching ethos is challenge the players to get better all the time, never stand still. So I tried to bring that thought and that extra little bit of focus into those sides. Hong Kong, they were always, unfortunately, just a little bit amateurish because there were players that a lot of them were expats, either from Pakistan or Australia or New Zealand. But the biggest problem there is we went to Canada to play in an ICC tournament. And Hong Kong, I'm sure, have you been to Hong Kong? The grounds there are like postage stamps, very small. First game, we had a reasonable side. We had two quick bowlers who were good at associate level. And we got to the first game, played on a huge school field. There was about 5 pitches on one big open expanse, bit of grass. Anyway, these outfields were enormous. I say enormous. They were large cricket fields, you know, normal size, but on the larger side. Obviously, this was alien to Hong Kong. Well, the two quick bowlers threw their arm out in the first game, throwing the ball from the boundary. Then we had what, 5 or 6 games left. My two quick bowlers were out. We're just done. Just, you know, what's taught me over the years is, especially in tournament play, you've got to do your homework. What sort of wickets are you going to play on? What grounds are like? And then prepare accordingly. Preparation is another thing Bob used to say. You know, preparation is so good. The small things will make a difference when you get to, especially tournament play, where you're looking to get better throughout the tournament. My record in coaching has been pretty good, well, better than pretty good in tournament play. I mean, with New Zealand, we got to the final of the Champions Trophy. I got to the quarterfinal in the World Cup with New Zealand. With the Bahamas just now, we got third in the America's group, and we went through. Unfortunately, we were totally outplayed by Canada in the playoffs to go to the World Cup next year. We got to within two games of going to the World Cup, but we were outplayed. But it was all about learning what we're playing on. We went to Argentina. I might be jumping ahead now from where you go, but we went to Argentina. The wickets were dry from the year before. I knew there would be. We played 5 spinners. And just because of what we learned from, we prepared and we got the batters to learn how to sweep more. And we ended up, we were ranked 5 or 6 in that competition. And we finished second, but third on run rate. So we beat Argentina. They were the favourites to go through to the next round. So it's all about, you know, coaching. I say to all coaches, just try and do a little bit of homework, a little bit of preparation. you know, if you know you're at the weekend, you're going to play on a quick, fast bouncy wicket, try and get your groundsman to prepare your midweek nets, if you can, to mimic what you're going to play at the weekend, so the batters get used to and prepare accordingly, like for like.
Some of that is absolute gold, but it also shows the limitations, as you said, with, if, you know, there's three grounds in Hong Kong, none of them are particularly big. You know, the players, I remember I've seen that before with players, you know, struggling in all those sorts of situations when they get to the, like an associate level tournament. How do you go from all that to coaching domestically in New Zealand? You go to Northern Districts first, I think, in New Zealand. Is that right?
Yeah. So what happened is that I thought I had the Warwickshire job. Tim Munton, who was my best mate, was chairman of the cricket board, cricket committee. He held the interviews. He was chairman of the panel, and it ended up being 2-2. And Tim thought he had the casting vote, so I was in. But unfortunately, they decided that no, they wanted to do the panel again. It was between me and Great Batch. So they changed the panel, and Great Batch got voted in. So it was very difficult. But Warwickshire, I mean, go back to when I wanted to play. I was trying to get into Warwickshire as a player. I've tried, probably five times to get involved at Warwickshire in a coaching capacity, but I failed every time for whatever reason. I mean, I've coached Test cricket, I've coached all around the world, but I couldn't get into my own county somewhere. Mm. I applied for the pathway coach to help the under-19s. No, I couldn't get in. I just feel, unfortunately, that Warwickshire, the only way I can look upon it now is that it's like having a girlfriend. I love her, but she doesn't love me back for whatever reason. So I've come to terms with it. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to work there, but it's one of my greatest regrets that I never had an opportunity to coach at Warwickshire.
Yeah. So you go to Northern Districts, and then you quickly become, well, not quickly, but you become like an assistant coach within the New Zealand setup. Is that how that, and then that sort of progresses to the head job?
No, it wasn't this. What happened is that I got the job at Northern Districts. So we won the 4-day championship, first year calling. Next year, we got through to the 1-day final or the 1-day semi-final. And then Bracewell decided that he was going to move on. So they advertised it. And again, we all dream of, the whole idea, we all want to get better. We want to be tested at the highest level. So I didn't think I'd get the job, so I applied for it. And lo and behold, I did get the opportunity. And it was, it's in the book. There's player power happened there, all sorts of different things. But I loved it. I mean, yes, I walked in with eyes wide open. Mm. I knew there would be issues. I knew that a group of the players wanted more control. They wanted to, because Bracewell was a very, very strict disciplinarian, and they wanted more say on the way they practiced and the way they did things, which I had no problem with. My problem, looking back, is that I was too soft on them. By the CEO came to me after I'd been in the job for about 2 or 3 months, and said, look, Dan wants more control, Dan Vittori. I said, okay, well, so what do you want me to do? He said, step back, let him and maybe one or two of the senior players have more say. And I thought, well, okay, if that's what you want. I said, but, got to be careful anyway. So, how long's a piece of string? They got more control, more control, more control. So, I could see it coming. I've been down this road so many times. When you see things, you think, well, that might be a dead end there we're going down for me. So I started taking notes about things they said, things they've done with the board, not with the players, with the board, and how happy they were. And they gave me promotion into being onto the. When I first started, I was just an advisor to the selectors. Then they brought me on because they were happy. Everything. So there was an acknowledgement that I was, and they told me things are doing well. And then when it all went sour, my last game for them was coaching in the ICC Champions Trophy final. They'd only been there once before. Mm. And me, within 8 months of me taking over, we got to a final. Now, don't get me wrong, it's all the players. I will never say they got to that final because of me, because that is wrong. If any coach who says that, they're bonkers. players are the people that, and the way they play. All I do is set an environment and practice regime and a understanding of no shortcuts and encouragement to try and help them achieve what the best that they're able to. So we finished the game. We lost against a very, very strong Australian team, Ponting and all the rest of them. So I got home. That was in Pretoria. So I live in Cape Town. So I went home to see my kids. And I got a phone call the next day from New Zealand, from the manager, Dave Curry. Andy, you need to get on a plane and come back here tomorrow. We've got a meeting with the board. You get a phone call like that, you know it's not good. So I said, okay. So I got on a plane, flew all the way back, and then it became a player. The CEO said to me, look, we all know you're a great coach, but you're not the coach the players want. I said, well, you appointed me for 2 years, 18 months. What's it going to, you appointed me, you and the board. Mm. Why now are you telling me that the players don't want me? You've just been in a final. We've just come from Sri Lanka where we beat them in the T20 competition there. We beat India at home in a T20 series. Yes, we lost the test series or drew one-day series, but we were improving. At the time I was there, Ross Taylor had only played four test matches or six test matches. Very young team, very growing team. And I thought we were slow. We were going places. But no, the players wanted more their person. Which, okay, fine. At the end of the day, and I understand it, if the players don't want you, it's a waste of time being there because they're not going to listen to you. So I went to the – so they said they wanted arbitration. Mm. So, okay, we'll do arbitration, of which a gentleman comes in and he says, right, I'm going to listen to both sides of the story and I'll make a call about how we are. At the moment, New Zealand Cricket, Andy, are offering you 3 months' money. I said, yeah, I've still got a year or 11 months left on my contract. Mm. So my lawyer said, no, that's not fair. He's had no letters of warning. He's had no communication. All he has had, and what I did, you see, I saved all the emails where they were saying, well done. So we printed out, put it on the table. All we've had from New Zealand Cricket is this proof that they are happy with the way things are going. So the guy who did the arbitration just said, okay, go to your different rooms. And he said to New Zealand Cricket, I hope you brought your checkbook with you because you're going to pay. And they paid me out my contract. But I left Scotland, I left New Zealand. It's never nice when it sort of turns around to this. But eyes wide open. I've got no negative things to say about New Zealand cricket. I've got no negative things to say about Scotland. It happens in there and then. I look back on it what a great learning experience. And it's made me a better coach.
It's interesting because you said before that you loved your time there, but you do in the book talk about how you lost a little bit of love for the game at times when you had to go through some of that.
Yeah, when I left New Zealand, I didn't like the game at all. I put my heart and soul into what I wanted to do with the New Zealand. So I spoke to the players. We just played in the final of the Champions Trophy. We were growing. I could see the team growing. Things were starting to happen. And then when it happened and the way it happened, I rang, when I got to New Zealand, flying back, I rang three or four of the senior players and none of them, I think they call it ghosting these days, none of the players answered the phone. Mm. I thought, well, what's going on? But as I was saying about what I found out afterwards, I'm talking about when I was writing the book with Geoffrey Dean, only then, so that's a good 10, 12 years later, did I find out that New Zealand Cricket had told the players not to speak to me because their lawyers had advised them, don't speak to him because we're looking to end his contract. Do not get into conversations with him, which I didn't know. Mm. So that's why, I couldn't get anyone to talk to, find out what was going on. All I said to Dan and to the other players, just tell me, if you don't want to work with me, just say so and I'll get on the plane and I'll go home. I'm not going to force myself upon you guys. Mm. But I think we're starting to have some sort of growth. Maybe we have to change one or two things to make you happier with the way that things are going around the team environment. But can't you see we're having growth? And just tell me if you don't want me. Because if you don't want me, I'm not going to bang my head against a brick wall. Mm. Then I'll move on. Don't worry about it. But I never got any response from any of them. So therefore, that just took the love of, for that group of players away from me, because they had a slogan that they lived by: in the belly, not in the back. That's when I first joined the group. They showed me a video. They had a very professional video made about their culture and the team, and it was all support. You know, we support one another. We never leave anybody behind, all this sort of stuff. But the slogan, the last slogan, if you've got a problem, in the belly, not in the back. So in other words, knife them in the belly. Mm. At least you do it face to face, but never in the back. We're not that sort of type. And yet there they were, very much so, in the back and not in the belly.
Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today.
Yeah, what's really interesting is from the book, that the news story that goes viral when your book comes out is the story about Brendan McCullum, where you say, I want you to play more defensively. I want you to knock it around for a little while. We've got a younger team. And he says, that's not my brand. I want to play this cricket. And so the story that goes around is you talking about McCullum not playing the way you wanted. But the book's actually very positive on Brendan McCullum.
Yeah.
That one story is kind of, that's a story that you're telling about an interaction, but it's very positive. It's Daniel Vettori where you have the bigger issues, realistically. And it's interesting the way that when that book comes out, the media sort of jump on the one little bit and not the sort of the overarching story of that. Were you a bit surprised that it became about you and McCullum?
Not really. I mean, when you've been around, 40 years, as I have, as is the title of the book, you see the way the press and the media, they're looking to create a story. They're looking to, I mean, when it came up, I was angry because I, as you said, if you read the book, I'm disappointed in how he responded to that question, because my job as the coach was trying to get that team to win there and then today. So I said to him, I just needed to hang around for 5 or 6 more overs before what he became world class at, charging down the wicket and smashing. Don't forget, it was the infancy of Brendan playing that style of cricket as well. So he was still learning. And I was saying, just give yourself a little bit longer. By that, you can get yourself in. Plus, the players can get their feet under the table as well, so to speak. And I, as you say, the guys, if people buy the book, I also quite clearly put in there that, he said, no, he's building Brand McCullum. Don't forget, the IPL hadn't started yet. The IPL was only happening. All the auctions were happening in about 2 months' time at this conversation. So all the players, Brendan, the way he played, were all looking at that payday there. They're looking to impress upon the IPL teams that they're the person they should be looking. So I understand what's going on. And I put in there, and if you've read it, who's to say it wasn't the right thing for the team that I needed, but who can criticise him when you look at what he's done?
Mm.
Both in New Zealand, in the IPL, coaching England now. The thing is, you can look at England team now. Not anyone could go, that would be a very disastrous thing for me to say, but he's very lucky to have a team with that quality all the way down the batting order. When I was in New Zealand, we didn't have that. So my 2 or 3 good players had to dig in at the top of the order and then be expressive as we went on. But you look at that England team, they've got players coming in at 8, 9, 10 in the test matches, scoring 50s. Well, we didn't have that luxury. So I tried to get Brendan to look at what we needed today, not tomorrow or in 3 weeks' time, but today we needed, or I requested for him to play a certain way. And he said, no, he's building his Brand McCullum because that's how he wants to go forward and that's how he's building his career. And I could understand that. Looking back, and at the time, I could understand it. But it wasn't what Bob Woolmer had drummed into me when we were trying to be successful. The team always comes first. And that's a point I was trying to make in the book. And I also made a point in the book that Brendan, who's to say that I was right? Look at the way things have gone for Brendan now. And he's been very successful. And quite rightly, he's probably the most enterprising coach in the world at the moment. because of the group of players that he could work with. And, you know, I've got nothing against Brendan whatsoever. I just asked him to try and help out that day, or for that series. So I think we had another two or three games left in that series. Could he just pull back on the reins a little bit whilst we get this team, youngsters, feet under the table, and then go on and play the way you're going to play? But, you know, he didn't want to do that.
Well, the interesting thing about all that is that when they're bowled out for, what was it, 45 in Cape Town, and this would have been years after you had this conversation with him, they have a conversation where McCullum basically says, we're being selfish. We're thinking about ourselves as players. You know, we're not thinking about New Zealand anymore. So he doesn't change his brand at that point, because by that stage, he has worked out that that is the best way for him to play. And obviously he helps change New Zealand cricket. And now he's been involved in England and had some success in the IPL as well. So we know that it worked, but the selfishness, he goes from being a player that does think about himself a little bit to being almost the ultimate team man who's diving headfirst into boards and everything. And maybe that was just a little bit of maturity that he needed. And that is probably, that with the brand of cricket is what has become about Brendan McCullum now.
Exactly the word I was going to use is that we all mature with age. Some mature quicker than others. We've all worked with players that some seem to, the penny drops before others. 100% right. With maturity becomes, you know, recognition of responsibility and all those sort of catchphrases. And I think Brendan, over the next, once I'd gone over the next two or three, 4 years, understood what the team needed from him, so he could do a bit of both.
Moving on to Afghanistan, because this is a fascinating part of your career as well. I was there at the 2015 World Cup, and I must have covered 2, 3, 4 of your games. And, you know, I was at training sessions and traveling around. And I remember being in Canberra, and, you know, they've got the big open nets at Monica Oval. So, you know, I was just standing, you know, next to the nets. And you were taking, I can't remember which bowler it was now. I think it was Dolat Zadran. You would take him and show him how to bowl cross seam deliveries. And I'd been around professional cricket for, you know, 8-10 years by that point. I'd never seen an international coach teach someone something that I had learned when I was a kid, right? You know, a very simple cricket thing. And it struck me that you'd had all these different things, but the Afghanistan job was still so removed from everything else, because these kids had not grown up with cricket balls in their hands, right? They had not grown up in the same way that, you know, that normal cricket teams had. So you had, as you said before, you had dangerous players because they were very talented, but they were so raw. And it was almost like you were more of a teacher than a coach at times with that team.
Yeah. Well, the issue is to a certain degree, it's still valid today. They don't play enough cricket. So they don't play. So the national side don't play much cricket, but then the A team plays even less cricket. The under-23s or the under-19s play a little bit more cricket, but still not enough, because they're part of the ICC under-19 program where they play the World Cups every 2 years. But once they get above that, there's not enough cricket. In Afghanistan, they do have a first-class structure, but there's not many, you know, there's some good coaches and there's some coaches that aren't so good. So even with the national, I mean, I was teaching them how to back up some of them. You know, and there they were in a World Cup, you know, proper World Cup situation. But I'm pleased to say that, you know, under Jonathan Trott and before him, Phil Simmons, they've got themselves, you know, and I helped as well. But I did a lot, although I worked with the first team, I did a lot of work with the under-19s and the A team. And a lot of those players have come through now, have come through that program. But again, it's not about me. All I do is ensure no shortcuts, hard work, review your own performances and what can you learn. So those same messages all the time, never to get too big for their boots, and understand that you know, team comes before an individual. Now, there's, what, 5 or 6 points there, but very simple. Now, Bob used to always sort of say, you know, if you get the basics right, in the T20 competitions, if you bowl less wides than the opposition, less no balls, and you get more singles, yeah, we look at the boundary counts and the game's changed now with, you know, the so many sixes and fours. But if you cut down your simple mistakes, more often than not, you win games. So Afghanistan is a hive of cricket. It's like Pakistan and India. everywhere you look, there's kids playing cricket. It's their way out of the slums. So the, you know, we had a leg spin. Khan, obviously magnificent, world best probably leg spinner at the moment in white ball cricket. So they all want to copy him. They're all the kids. So we had just in Kabul. Now they've got about seven or eight different cricket centres around the country, provinces. But in Kabul, we had a leg spin competition, find a new leg spinner. We had about 300 to 400 kids turn up, so under 19s. Well, I could tell we had to send a lot home because they were more like 29 than 19. you know, we had to filter that out. But out of that, we ended up having about 200 bowlers that we spent a weekend with. Out of that 200 that had been, 20 of them were good enough to play first-class cricket. And we'd never seen them before. They just taught themselves. They have this thing called tape ball cricket. I don't know if you've come across it. Mm. They play in the streets and they're fanatics about cricket. You know, the guys now, I mean, we used to hear, you know, because all the games are played out of Afghanistan for obvious reasons. Nobody will come to Afghanistan. When we were with the team and we'd win games of cricket, there'd be videos of AK-47s and rocket launchers being fired into the sky, you know, in celebration. Now, thankfully, they've worked and tried to educate everybody that what goes up comes down. You know, there was people, unfortunately, were dying through gunfire, you know, 2 miles away from where the fight's setting the guns off. But there's just absolute unbridled passion for the cricket.
You say no one would visit Afghanistan, of course, that's right for teams, but you lived in Kabul, right? Like, you were in the heart of it, and there were times when you had, you know, very good security around you and everything else, but there are other times when you're just kind of living in the stadium and, you know, on your own. That is not, you know, I know you've worked everywhere and you've had all these different jobs, but that is not a normal thing for a cricket coach to have to deal with.
I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting.
No, when I first went to Afghanistan, I turned up at flew from Cape Town to Dubai, and then you get the flight from Dubai. So I went to the gate, the lounge, the gate, just waiting to get on the Emirates flight to Kabul. And all down one side of the concourse was all the Afghans, both males and females, obviously all covered up, the ladies all covered up in their national dress. And the men with their long flowing robes and hats. And on the other side were all the army contractors going out there to do like G.I. Joes. And there was, like two sides just staring at each other. I thought, what the bloody hell have I let myself in for here? I got off the plane at the other side, took to a hotel. And, you know, they're going, it's all in the book about the security you have to go through. They let you know where the safe room is in the basement of the hotel if there's an issue. You know, terrorists get involved and they can lock you in basically it's a safe. So you just live in, you know, in a safe, people come around. But, you know, I was there, you know, unfortunately we had a T20 competition when they call it Spagiza, which is Urdu for six, Spagiza. So we're playing a game there and a suicide bomber tries to get into the ground, and there's probably about 15,000 to 16,000 in the ground. Adam Holyoak is coach of the opposition team, and we're sat basically in two dugouts next to each other, 10 metres apart. And we just hear this boom, and we're looking at what the hell's that? And then literally about 3 or 4 seconds later, there's a wave comes through your body. It's a black wave. I'll never forget it. Very weird feeling. Anyway, so we got the players off, got them into the cricket authority said, oh, it was a gas canister that went off. But we all knew, the players said, no. They knew, the player, we were foreigners. I've never seen a bomb go off before. So they could have made out that it was a gas canister. But the player said to me, no, that's not a gas canister, that's a bomb. And what happened is that a suicide bomber was trying to get into the ground, and one or two of the security guards, who were paid about $8 a day, US dollars, pittance, one of them saw this guy with his vest and jumped on top of him and hugged him. So when he let his bomb off, he suffocated the blast. This guy, for $10 a day, gave his life up for, and around him were probably about 30 or 40 people trying to get into the ground, and he saved their lives. This security guard, unbelievable when you think about, you know, his bravery. So there were times, you know, I'd be asleep at night and hear a whistling noise going overhead. Now the rockets. So Kabul center has a mile, we call it the Ring of Steel. Around Kabul is concrete fences and steel fences, and at each access point there'd be a tank and 20 or 30 soldiers at each point around, so stopping Taliban from getting in. Terrible traffic jams, but that's how the security is. And then, so what they did is the Taliban would set up outside of this Ring of Steel and just set off these rockets with different amounts of propellant in them. So as it came into over Kabul, some would land after 300 meters, 400, 5, 6, 7, 800 to a kilometer. And so they basically fell wherever there's no precision aiming or anything like that. So I just used to pray, just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Thankfully, as long as you keep hearing the whistling, you're fine. You start to worry when you hear a whistle and it stops. Hmm. And you think, oh, bloody hell, just, where's that going to fall? So that's probably the most, with the bombing and hearing those rockets going over, is probably the worst moments where you feel actually under pressure. I mean, I got a message. It's in the book. I got a message sent to me. There's an old man that worked in the at the cricket ground. He used to be a caretaker in the players. We had a house where the players stayed, dormitories, and he used to sweep and clean that. And he just said to me, the players and the other guys, other coaches said, no, he's part the political part of the Taliban. That's that fella there. Lovely old man. And he couldn't speak a word of English, but said to one of the other guys who translated to me, said, the Taliban said, Mr. Moles, you're fine. We will not come after you because we like cricket is saying to the world that Afghanistan is doing well. They like the fact that they're on the front page and for cricket. But if I happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, then that's just unfortunate. You know, if I happen to be at a checkpoint that they attack, or if I happen to be by a roadside bomb, then that's just unfortunate. But they did say, which maybe felt a little bit better, that they wouldn't purposely come and target. Because the biggest other issue is kidnapping.
Yeah, so, Muhammad, you know, Nabi and his father.
Nabi and one or two other guys, they got kidnapped. And what they do is my brother was involved in anti-terrorism in the London Met. And he, before I went, he wasn't happy that I went, by the way. Before I went, we had to do a question and answers where I had to, because if anything happened, the first thing they do is we want proof of life, basically, that I'm still alive. So there'd be six questions that they had no idea. So what was the name of my first dog? What was the name of my first girlfriend? What was, you know, total obscure stuff that there's no way they could, so, you know, that they could turn. If the answers were to those questions were correct, then they knew I was alive.
It's phenomenal, that part of your story. But what I find more interesting is that you live through this for, you know, a long period of time, as I said, with varying levels of security around you at different times. But as you mentioned at the top of the show, you lost your leg, but you don't lose your leg through like a bomb or anything. It's something far more innocuous.
Yeah. So I'm in, we go to Dubai, to the UAE, to get ready for the tour to go to Bangladesh. And I decide to go for a walk one day in the midst, only mad dogs and Englishmen, they say walk in the midday sun. So I went, it was midday, I decided I'd go for a walk. And I didn't put any socks on, just put my training shoes on, and I went for a walk for probably 3/4 of an hour. Came back, and I thought, oh, that pavement must be hot, because my bottom of my foot is burning. Anyway, so I took my shoes off, my cloak, because it was stinking hot. It was 42, 43 degrees. Had a shower, came back into the bedroom part of my room, sat down and thought, bloody hell, there's blood on the floor. Where's that blood come from? And what I've done is I literally got a blister on the total ball of my foot. It just came away. So it was red raw. So anyway, so what happens, I end up having to have, when I get to Bangladesh, I have to have skin graft. So I have skin graft. And then after about 2 weeks or so, I get a moon boot because I can't walk. So I get this moon boot, which is a Afghan-made moon boot, not one of the modern things you see in the Western world. But I thought that's working fine. Everything's good. But what happened is on the side of the moon boot, where it comes up, where your little toe is, it wore a little blister on my little toe. And whilst I was in Afghanistan, or then after that we went through to India, I contracted an MRSA bug, which is a flesh-eating bug. Don't know where it came from, how it got in, but it got in through my little toe. So I was coming back to Cape Town, and the doctor, Lance Klusner, was coming back to take over the team. I was looking after him while he was away. And he said, look, when you get back to Cape Town, the team doctor said, get yourself to your normal doctor. So I'm not quite happy with that toe. Get it looked at. So I came back and the doctor took a swab, says, we'll get back to you later today. We'll send it off. I had a phone call 4 hours later. Get yourself down to the hospital. They're waiting for you. You need antibiotics intravenously straight away. So I go off and I'm in there for about 9 days, just pumping this stuff into me. And unfortunately, the specialists are coming to see it every other day, and they warn me, no, the little toe has got to come off. It's dying. But then at this stage, they didn't tell me it was an MRSA. They just said it's an infection. So they amputated the little toe, and they said, right, come back in 5 days' time, and we'll have a look at it. Well, unfortunately, that night, I woke up in the middle of the night with my leg all red, swollen. I've got a temperature. Now I've got a proper infection. So I go back to the hospital. They put me in a room. Now the chief, who is a great man, the chief specialist comes around and he said, look, I've got to warn you, Andy. It doesn't look great. He says, you've got a flesh-eating bug is there in the bone, and we could take another toe off if you want. So, but if it gets any further and starts to go up your leg, then your life is in the. So I promise you, I said to him, right, Doc, you wouldn't tell me how to play a forward defensive. I'm not going to tell you how to do your job. What do you suggest? He says, I'm sorry, mate. We're going to have to amputate you just below your knee. And I said, well, when can you do that? This was at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. He said, we'll do it at 12 o'clock today. I said, right, let's get on with it then. And I went down, had it cut off. And I think this is where I steeled myself to my situation, was when I came round. So I came round probably about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was the first day in South Africa of lockdown, COVID, April the 1st. Can you believe it? April, I have my leg cut off. So I'm there and I suddenly see these bodies, white sheets being wheeled past the end of my thing. There must have been two or three. And it was the first deaths from COVID. And I saw and it just made me realize, why are you feeling sorry for yourself? Why on earth must you think that life's been tough on you? Yeah, I've got, and look now, yes, there's been hard times and there's been dark days. But at the end of the day, I've got half a leg. So what? I've got a prosthetic, I can get around. You know, those poor people who have lost their lives. And that really, and I look upon life now where my glass is always half full. It's never half empty. And I talk to youngsters. I talk to players. I mean, the little bit of coaching. I've applied for a few jobs since I've got my leg back and sort of mobility back. But unfortunately, one-legged coaches are not very popular on the circuit. So, but the Bahamas have got hold of me and said, you know, would I come out there? And I said, look, before we go any further, I'm just going to say you understand I've only got one leg. He said, I don't want you to play. I want you for what's in your head. I said, okay. And his name's Greg. He's a fantastic man, president of the Bahamas Cricket Association, and we've become very close friends. And I go out there now. I've been out there 4 times, about 6 weeks every year, try and help with, bringing on the players. Listen, the cricket at times is not great. I get a bit frustrated, but there's plenty of worse places like Afghanistan to be rather than the Bahamas.
Yeah, it's not a bad gig to get when you're not coaching. I can see that. It's an incredible life story, and it really is worth anyone who's enjoyed this to go and get the book, because the book is fantastic. But you have had a unique career, as we talked about at the start. It's why I wanted to get you on and talk about this. But you've worked with all these different cricket cultures. Is cricket different around the world? Is it the same around the world? Is it just, you know, what have you noticed from someone who's been to so many different places working in cricket?
Basically, it is the same all around the world. What differs is the amount of interference from people that should know better, you know, administrators. I went to a conference at the Emirates Stadium. Arsene Wenger was the keynote speaker, and he drew a football pitch sort of like this. In our terminology, we draw a circle for the oval of a cricket ground. And he just said, I've come to learn that from the board to the selectors, to the coaches, to the players, to the ground staff, everybody you can think of, if they make every decision that positively impacts on the inside of that circle, then you're going to have some success. And he said, but unfortunately, you'll come across people who make decisions for things that are going to happen outside of that circle. And that, you know, rocks. Another thing that rocks the table. And let me tell another thing that Bob Woolman used to tell me. To be a successful cricket team, a successful organisation, you've got to have four strong legs on the table to keep it solid. If one of those legs is shorter or one of those legs is missing, the table wobbles and falls over. And those four things are good facilities, practice and play, good squad, good captain and coach, and good administrators. If you've got four legs, strong legs, that table is rock solid. But all it needs is poor practice facilities or poor playing facilities, and you can have the other three, the table won't be solid. If you've got a squad that's got a poor captain or a poor coach, or, you know, three or four players are not pulling, that table leg will not be strong. Administrators, they've got to support the players and they've got to make strong decisions, and there's got to be respect. Not from players to them, but the administration to the players. So I also look very strongly when I go to organisations, how strong are those pillars around on those to keep that table stable.
Thank you very much for being on the show, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.